So Daniel chapter 5. King Belshazzar made a great feast for thousands of his lords and drank wine in front of the thousand. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold, of silver, that Nebuchadnezzar, his predecessor, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem, be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, their wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. And the king, his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His color changed and his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall. And the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father and your predecessor, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your predecessor the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." And Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my predecessor, brought from Judah. I've heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation. But they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I've heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple, have a chain of gold around your neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself, and give your rewards to another. Nonetheless, I will read the writing to the king, and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your predecessor, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened, so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of the house of the and the vessels of the house of the Lord have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives and concubines have drunk from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose all your ways you have not honoured. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed, and this is the writing that was inscribed: Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parthen. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed in purple, a chain of gold was put around his neck, and proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler of the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old.
Very much. Thank you very much, Paul, for reading that long and very vivid passage. Well, brothers and sisters of Granville Street, it's very nice to be with you again and to see so many familiar faces and one or two new ones as I look out amongst you. Somebody's already mentioned the archers, and the scriptwriters of the archers are brilliant, aren't they, at leaving you hanging on a particular episode so that actually you want to tune in again next Monday or whenever it is in order to hear the next episode. And the stories that are put before us from the book of Daniel are a little bit like that, each one vivid and thrilling so that you actually want to come back and read the next exciting instalment. I'm only sorry that I'm not going to be here next week when you have the most famous of all the stories, Daniel in the Lion's Den, because frankly I should be fascinated to see how you manage to mix lions and small children in this confined space. But as it is, I've got the privilege of dealing with Daniel chapter 5, Belshazzar's feast, one of the string of pearls of these great stories from the book of Daniel. One which has inspired great music, great art, as we'll see in a minute, and, of course, has bequeathed us one of the most famous sayings in the English language, which we use, frankly, all the time in familiar discourse, don't we? The writing on the wall. But just to recap very briefly and put the story into context, you've heard in previous weeks, I'm sure, from the speakers who've taken you through 1 to 4 of Daniel, that we're dealing here with the catastrophic failure of the kingdom of Israel and Judah. A whole series of frankly inept and corrupt kings had actually brought God's judgment on the nation, and that had been delivered in the character and personality of the king Nebuchadnezzar. For the historians among you, Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians attacked the kingdom of Israel and Judah twice, first in 597 BC, and second in 586. And when he came the second time in 586, he did a pretty thorough job. You can read about it at the end of 2 Chronicles. He sacked the city of Jerusalem, Solomon's temple was destroyed and set on fire, and the treasury from the goblets and the chalices and the vessels of gold and silver were taken from the temple treasury and from the king's treasury and taken to Babylon. The other thing he did was to decapitate the kingdom, by which I mean that he took into captivity in Babylon hundreds, nay thousands, of the best educated, the academics, the professionals, the administrators, the teachers, the doctors, all those who, as in a sense, were the elite of the kingdom and on whom it relied, took those into captivity in Babylon. Now, we are in probably about 540 BC, 539 BC, so 50 or 60 years later. Don't forget, of course, that when you're dealing with BC, numbers, the lower numbers are come after the higher numbers. So 540 BC is after 580 or 590, not before, as it would be in AD. And we have a king in charge now called Belshazzar. You'll notice that Paul once or twice referred to him as his successor of Nebuchadnezzar, and once or twice as his son. The word is not clear in the original. It's unlikely, actually, that he was Nebuchadnezzar's son, but certainly a successor, anyway. And Belshazzar gives this great banquet, a mother and father of a blowout, really. 1,000 nobles and all their wives and concubines are gathered in this vast hall, and he lays on the ultimate spread, really. You wouldn't want to go anywhere afterwards, because you would have eaten and drunk so much. And in the middle of it, having had probably a bit too much to drink, Belshazzar orders that the goblets and the chalices and the drinking vessels that were stolen from Jerusalem by his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar are brought in. And he offers a toast in them to the gods of Babylon, the gods made out of gold and silver, stone, iron and wood. And at that point, something dramatic happens. A hand appears on the wall and begins writing in the plaster. Sort of al fresco stuff, which a lot of Renaissance painters might have been familiar with, but here, an astonishing and dramatic intervention. And of course, Belshazzar can't make head or tail of it. What's going on? There's some writing here, you can just about make that out, but nothing else. So he summons, of course, as you do, the astrologers and the wise men, the magicians from his own culture, and asks them what it means. They have no idea, and there's quite a commotion, as you can imagine, in the banqueting hall. And then somebody with a bit of common sense arrives. Might have been the queen, might have been the queen mother. Again, the scripture is not entirely clear. She comes in and she says, "What's all the fuss about?" And Belshazzar, probably by now speechless, points to the writing on the wall, and she says, "Oh, don't worry about that. No, there's a very wise chap here that we captured from the Jews so many years ago. Nebuchadnezzar thought that he was the top when it came to interpreting this sort of thing. Send for him. He's called Daniel. He'll tell you what it means." Daniel is sent for, offered this great reward, purple robe, gold chain round his neck, number 3 in the kingdom, says, "Don't want any of that, but I'm going to tell you what it means." And he explains, talks about the way Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar's predecessor, was allowed by God to function as a king in whatever way he chose, but had judgment on him. And then the punch comes. "Judgment has come on you, and you have been found wanting, and your kingdom is going to fall and be handed over to foreigners." That's the summary of chapter 5 of Daniel. Would you like to do a little art appreciation now? Very good. Well, Tim's got a picture of one of the most famous interpretations of this story. I wonder if we can have the lights out, please. As long as you promise not to go to sleep while the lights are out, okay? I think it's those down there. Very good. So I think we can see that well enough. So here we have Belshazzar. I shouldn't worry too much about the curtains, that's okay. Here we have Belshazzar in the centre of the picture. And he's got this magnificent turban and this lovely gold cope. So you can see that the Rembrandt's gone to great lengths to portray him with all his finery and his riches and his power. And he's just at the moment when he's noticed the writing on the wall and beginning to wonder what on earth it is. And so his body is sort of recoiling. Can you see that? Sort of recoiling. And his eyes are open wide in horror, really, or in amazement of what this writing actually is and what it could mean. And surrounding him are some of his courtiers and a servant girl in the foreground on the bottom right. And you can see that right in the act of pouring wine or of drinking wine, their astonishment and surprise has led them to knock the glasses over. And the wine itself is being poured out, falling on the floor because of their astonishment. Do you notice also that in the writing, there is no light source coming from the other side of the picture onto the writing? The light comes from the writing, comes from within. The writing is powerful. It brings light into this darkness. It's what the art historians call, in Italian, chiaroscuro, dark light. And it's a very well-known technique amongst the master painters, making this strong contrast between light and dark. So the light comes from within the writing itself. The writing itself is the power and doesn't need any other light source in order to draw attention to it. So there is poor Belshazzar, this moment of astonishment and amazement. It's an enormously powerful picture, because the setting we've had in the story is of this huge hall with 1,000 and more people in it, and you would think that an artist would want to portray this vast scene. And in fact, there is a painting painted in 1821 by an English artist called Martin, which does just that. Well, what's so good about this picture is the way that Rembrandt has focused right down. It's as if the camera has gone right in close up on the impact of this powerful and extraordinary writing on a wall on one man, on Belshazzar himself. So I think it's enormously powerful and very psychologically impactful. Right, that's enough art history. Can we have the lights back on now, please? Now, I wonder whether, when you were listening to that story, it reminded you of anything. Did it remind you of any other similar story from the Bible? Any other occasion when a Jew is living under an oppressive regime, where the ruler has a dream or a vision or an intervention which he knows to be divine somehow but doesn't understand, and this person is summoned to interpret? Joseph. Exactly. This story of Daniel at Belshazzar's feast is meant to remind us of the story of Joseph in Egypt. Why? Because through that one man and the gifts which he was given by God, truth is spoken to a power which does not recognize God's authority. That is the truth of Joseph and the truth of Daniel. And through what Joseph and Daniel said, the interpretation that they were able to give, the whole of history was changed. And alien gods came to realize, kings came to realize something which they had not understood previously. But even more than that, we are meant, the people who read this at the time did not understand this, but we, I think, can. This not only looks back to Joseph, it looks forward to somebody else. Somebody else living under the power of an alien and foreign regime which does not acknowledge the one true God, and who is able to speak truth to power and change history. Who is that? Jesus, exactly. So Daniel sits in the middle of the Bible, and he's like a signpost, and he points backwards to Joseph and forward to Jesus, and the message is the same. The message is, God is in control. God is sovereign. It doesn't look like it to Joseph. He's in Egypt, under an apparently unassailable regime. It doesn't look like it to Daniel. He's living in Babylon, under an apparently unassailable regime. It didn't look like it to Jesus, who was living under the Romans, an apparently unassailable regime. And yet, God uses those individuals to change history, to challenge the godless world and to call it to its senses. So the question is this: what is it that Belshazzar has done which is so displeasing to God? What is it that brings judgment on him? Well, we're told, aren't we? He brings out the goblets, the chalices, the drinking vessels, and what does he do? He doesn't just drink out of them. No, he uses them to provide a toast to his gods. The gods of gold and silver, iron and stone. His gods. This is a calculated, deliberate statement that he believes his gods to be greater than the one true living God. Don't misunderstand. There's a lot of casual blasphemy goes on in our society today. At the moment, I have an Indian lady living with us who is fleeing a case of domestic abuse. She doesn't have much English. She's an observant Hindu, but she also likes going to church. What little English she does have is liberally splattered with the phrase, "Oh my God." She says it all the time. When I told her yesterday that I'm a lay minister in the Church of England, because I had my robes, I'd been at a memorial service, she said, you're a minister of the church? Oh my God. Just like that. It's casual, everyday sort of, I don't blame her for that. That's not her fault. She's not making a concerted statement against God. Quite the reverse, actually. She's a God-fearer in her way. But where has she picked that up from? She's picked it up because she's only been in England for a year and she's been living with Indian people. She's picked it up from television. She's picked it up from casual discourse in the shops. She's picked it up from everyday wording that she's heard. Oh my God, we hear it everywhere, don't we? The phrase OMG is splattered all over social media. Now, I don't think we should blame people for that. When people are using that phrase casually, they don't know what they're doing. They're not doing the thing which Belshazzar was doing, which was a deliberate statement of opposition to God's authority. They're casually taking God's name in vain. And yet, isn't it sad? Isn't it sad when we are told that our speech should be like salt in the world? And that is how ordinary people speak. And occasionally, I mean, we've been reminded that one of the things that Daniel had to do was to speak truth to power. And it might be that occasionally, if you're with friends or neighbours who do splatter their conversation with that kind of phrase, that there's an opportunity for you just to question it. Mind how you do it, though. Mind how you do it. Because you don't want to put people's backs up unnecessarily, but just to make them think about what it is that they are saying, what that means, taking God's name in vain, so lightly, so casually. So Belshazzar is guilty of a deliberate, sustained confrontation against God's authority. And if there's nothing else that you take away this morning from this passage, it is that God is in control. God is sovereign, whatever the evidence. And brothers and sisters, we just prayed for our brothers and sisters in Palestine. I was in Palestine about 10 years ago, and I met several Palestinian Christians. There are now very, very few of them. Not just because of the war or the continual persecution of them by the Israelis, but because increasingly, as a counter to that, to be a Palestinian nowadays means to be a Muslim. And yet, this is one of the earliest and first churches of Christ in the world. Can you not imagine how those people must feel when they can read a passage like this? No matter the oppression that we are under, no matter the suffering that we go through, our God remains sovereign. And there's two other things I'd just like to say before I finish. Did you notice how Daniel said to Belshazzar, your predecessor Nebuchadnezzar did what he wanted. He raised up those he wanted to raise up. He humbled those he wanted to humble. He put to death those he wanted to put to death. How do we reconcile that with the fact that God is sovereign? God must, as it were, somehow allow this to happen. And I was reflecting on that and thinking, well, there's a man in the White House at the moment who doesn't seem to pay much attention to the tenets of God, who doesn't really seem to uphold the Christian values that I would hope would be upheld by the leader of a so-called Christian nation, who seems to fly in the face of a lot of the things which Nebuchadnezzar was reminded of that he needed to exercise. And yet, who's the man who's brought a ceasefire into the present situation? Who is the man who has at least enabled the possibility that the remaining hostages will be freed? Who is the man who has delivered or will deliver the aid into Gaza which they've been struggling to have for the last 5 months? Donald Trump. Isn't that an extraordinary paradox? Even a man like that can be used by God for good. But it doesn't remove the fundamental point that Daniel makes to Belshazzar. The reason your predecessor, he said, had this nervous breakdown and went off and ate straw like the ox was because he became proud and stubborn and cruel. And those are exactly the opposite of the values which all our leaders, at whatever stage or status in our society, should exercise. They should be humble. They should be able to admit when they're wrong. And they should be merciful. Those are core values in the heart of God. And every ruler is summoned to live by them. And Belshazzar didn't. And Nebuchadnezzar didn't. And the result was judgment. And the passage ends by saying that very night Belshazzar was slain. If you're interested in the history, the Medes and the Persians made an alliance. They attacked Babylon. Babylon had a big citadel in the middle. And it had a number of heavily defended gates around the walls, virtually impregnable, soldiers posted. But it had a weakness. The weakness was that the water supply flowed under the city. And there were sluice gates to let the water out. And they were not guarded. And I don't know whether you remember, but in one of the Lord of the Rings films, I think it's the Battle of Helm's Deep. The orcs get into the citadel through the sluice gates. It's an old idea that Tolkien may well have borrowed from history now, 540 BC. They got in through the sluice gates, and by the time the alarm was raised in the citadel, it was too late, and they took over the country. And not long afterwards, the Persian king Cyrus issued a proclamation, and he said, "Those of the Jewish people who have lived here for 70 years, who wish to go back to their own land, may do so." God changed history because he is and remains and always will be sovereign. Praise be the Lord.